Court is back in session.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. This is case number 78325, Crystal Glass versus Select Portfolio Services, Inc. We have Mr. Kern representing the appellant, Ms. Miller representing the respondent. Counsel will note that Justice Silver recused because she participated in this case when it was with the Court of Appeals. So Chief Justice Pickering is here with us today. She's going to fill in for Justice Silver on this case. Justice Stiglitz is in Carson City, and Chief Justice Pickering and myself are in Las Vegas, then like that. So with that being said, Mr. Kern, I know you filed an exhibit. So have you served Ms. Miller with it, the various documents you filed yesterday with the court?
Yes, we have, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Miller, do you have any objection to anything that Mr. Kern filed, those demonstrative exhibits?
Your Honor, I believe there was a timeline of events I had not seen previously, but the other exhibits are already part of the record, so I do not object to the documents that are part of the record.
Okay. Very well. Mr. Kern, you wish to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You may do so. By the way, I think you're both standing. If you're more comfortable to sit down at a desk or whatever, feel free to do so. We're a little less formal here with this procedure. So, okay, Mr. Kern, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court? To understand this case, it's important to fully understand the background of it. In this case, the lender filed a notice of default in which they also declared acceleration in August 2008 and thus made the loan wholly due. Thereafter, the bank attempted judicial foreclosure, where they produced a copy of an unendorsed note and attested under oath three separate times that this was the true and correct copy of the note and that it was in their possession. Despite being ordered by the court to produce the original, the bank never did, but gave two separate affidavits that the note was nonetheless in their possession and not lost. At trial, they claimed for the first time the note had been lost, but only since the last affidavit. Now, that case eventually went to the Court of Appeals, where it was held that there was no standing to enforce the note. Now, fast forward to the present action. Now the bank alleges that they have miraculously found the note, and not only that, despite having testified in 2015 that the unendorsed copy was true and correct, they now have a copy with an endorsement in blank by Countrywide, who ceased to exist in 2008. To date, the bank has not produced the original note or explained how a non-existent entity was able to endorse their note. Now, we have two issues on appeal here. First, that the 10-year rule, NRS 106-240, terminated the deed of trust after 10 years. Also, that issue preclusion prevents SPS from relitigating the question of their authority to enforce this note that was determined by the Court of Appeals. Now, regarding NRS 106-240, our legislature established that once a loan becomes fully due, if it has not been reinstated or foreclosed upon after 10 years, it must be presumed satisfied and terminated. Now, in this case,
I guess the question, Mr. Kern, I had, if I can interrupt you on the fully due, if it's fully amortized, I think the due date was in 2036, if you run the full scope of payments though, on it, and I know you argued it was accelerated, but if the notice of default was rescinded on that, then does that reinstate the note in the original time period on it?
Right. I'm glad you asked, Your Honor. Well, first, I'd like to point out that the language of that statute doesn't refer to the maturity date. It says becomes fully due. That's a more general term, and I'd point out that anything that makes it fully due would fall under that. And I think there's no question this court in Clayton v. Gardner made clear that when acceleration is declared, a note does become fully due. As far as the rescission, that's really the meat of the dispute with regard to this statute. And I think to understand it, we have to look at the language, which is why I provided the excerpts from the appendix. I'd like to direct the court to Exhibit 3 of those excerpts. And that is the notice of default. Now, as this court determined in the Hines case, a notice of default, a rescission, is not a contract. It accomplishes only what it gives notice of. And so we have to see what these documents actually give notice of. Now, if we look at the language of that notice of default, in the last paragraph before it says notice, we see the language that says two things that it does, and has declared and does hereby declare all sums secured thereby immediately due and payable, and has elected and does hereby elect to cause the trust property to be sold. These are two separate things that are accomplished by this. And as the Clayton versus Gardner case also said, that you can't presume acceleration from the filing of a notice of default. It's their option, so it has to say separately if it's going to do that. And here we see that it does. It declares the acceleration, makes the loan fully due, and it declares the default. Now we look at the rescission language, the rescission being the next exhibit, Exhibit 4 of that supplement, a somewhat shorter document. And what we're looking at here is this clearly does rescind the notice of default, and it says so right at the beginning. However, it limits what it does. By its own terms, quite intentionally, it says that it rescinds the notice of default. However, it goes on to say what it does not do, and it very clearly and intentionally says that it is and shall be deemed only an election without prejudice, not to cause a sale to be made. It goes on with language saying that this is not going to in any way affect or burden or harm any remedies they have available. And acceleration is one of those remedies available that they partook of.
Well, Mr. Kern, let me ask you about this, because it's a very good argument. It's interesting. I used to do this as a lawyer, so I'm kind of fascinated with this case. But NRS 107080 is the default statute on deeds of trust. Now, if you rescind the notice of default under 107080, you cannot accelerate it again for a period of time. I think it was 35 days. You know, that the default remains in default. So I think by operation of law, you would borrower, the trustor, would still have a right to cure the installments until that 35-day period expired on the reinstatement period in 107080. So I think you'd have to file a new notice of breach. They'd have the 35 days, and then it accelerates. But if that's not done, I would think it doesn't accelerate. But tell me why I'm wrong on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two reasons, Your Honor. First, I'd like to point out that specific language back in the notice of default, because they say has declared and does hereby declare all sums due. Meaning, first of all, they're saying by their own words that they have previously made a declaration of acceleration, and they are restating that here. So in that sense, rescinding the notice of default that simply restates the acceleration would have no effect on the acceleration they did before this.
Well, wouldn't that type of notice violate NRS 107080? I mean, they can say whatever they want, but they can't, whatever their recitals cannot conflict with the Nevada revised statutes on foreclosure. You can't do it.
Your Honor, I would point out that I don't believe 107080 specifies how acceleration can be declared. I think that is something that's contained solely within the language of the deed of trust. And this court did hold that under in the Clayton v. Gardner case, that it is the language of the deed of trust that determines when and under what circumstances acceleration can be declared. And if we follow that, we look at the same language further down in Gardner, that an acceleration can't be declared absent clear and unequivocal language. Because we're talking about notice to the borrower, as we said in Hines, that this only accomplishes what it gives as clear notice to the borrower, we have to apply this also to the reinstatement of the loan. So if we have filed something that gives clear notice that this is being accelerated, then and we're giving clear notice it's being accelerated, then in order to undo that, we have to give that borrower notice that and clear and unequivocal notice that it's being reinstated so they know that they have the right to start making payments again. And if you look at the language in this rescission, there is no language contained therein. And I will point out that this court, in an unpublished and uncitable decision, has previously followed this exact reasoning. And other courts, for example, Judge Boulware in the Nevada District, has considered it significant enough that they have followed that same reasoning, despite the fact that we can't cite that as law.
Okay. So what about the preclusion issue? What's your position on that?
With regard to the preclusion issue, it's clear that we have the same issue. It's clear that the issue is fully litigated on the merits of standing, and it's clear that we have the same parties. There's only two real issues here. First, the trial court apparently made a mistake, because if you look at the language there, they say that it can't be because it's a different claim. I think this court is fully aware that the difference between claim preclusion and issue preclusion, that issue preclusion does not require the claim to be the same one.
Who had the burden? Excuse me for a second. This is a quiet title action by your client, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you have the burden of establishing the right to have title quieted in your client.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that we are required to establish our good title, and the burden to establish any other property interest is on the other parties that are called in to defend their property interests.
They did not answer and counterclaim for quiet title in their own name. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And in the judicial foreclosure action, who had the burden?
In the judicial foreclosure action, they had the burden, but I would point out that any time that they attempt to enforce the lien against this property, they will always have the exact same burden. So we have to apply the same thing if we're going to follow equity. The whole purpose of this, of equity in general, is to avoid formalistic rules that leave property in limbo.
Do you think that in the judicial foreclosure context, you come in, I mean, you see it in the non-judicial foreclosure, they do a notice of default and election to sell, and then they can do a notice of rescission. It's less of a procedurally formal case than one to quiet title and for an equitable decree drawing on equity. Do you see any difference as far as incentive to litigate the issue in the judicial foreclosure context, which from this current your action to quiet title and in effect get a house freed of a $1 million mortgage?
Well, Your Honor, I'd say that at this point what we have to look at is the bank's wrongdoing. My client hasn't done any wrongdoing. She has been held in limbo for over 10 years now because the bank has done everything wrong. They have the duty to follow the law. They gave this loan with knowledge of Nevada law and all of its terms and all of its requirements. Now, if there
Mr.
is...
Mr. Kern?
Yes.
Mr. Kern, I'm sorry. When was the last time your client paid a mortgage payment?
My client, I don't believe, has, because she is not the party on the mortgage. However, if you look at Promax versus Feenstra, that was a similar case where there is no allegation of any payment whatsoever, and yet 106-240 was held to apply without exception, regardless of any such issues or concerns. This is per. Now, I do note that my time is running short, so I would ask to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you. You may do so. Ms. Miller, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Christina Miller, and together with Michael Kelly, we represent the Respondent Select Portfolio Servicing as servicing agent for U.S. Bank. I'd like to get straight into the 106-240 issue to start, because fundamental to this is that we've missed the first step. Does 106.240 even apply in this context? And the answer is no. In the Promax case almost two decades ago, this court declared that 106.240 is clear and unambiguous. It must be applied pursuant to its plain language. There's no room for construction, and we cannot look beyond the statute for its meaning. Based off of that ruling in Promax, looking at the plain language of 106.240, we know that we can only look to three potential documents: the deed of trust or mortgage, a written extension of the holy due date set forth in the deed of trust, or a recorded discharge. In this case, we don't have a written extension, nor do we have a recorded discharge of the lien. So we're solely talking about the deed of trust. And per 106.240 and its plain language, that is where the court must look to determine that holy due date. And as Your Honor mentioned previously, in the record at volume 1, page 98, we can see that that holy due date is January 1st of 2036. So on the plain language of the statute, as this court has already declared in Promax, 106.240 simply is not applicable here, where we have not yet run the course of the deed of trust per its own terms. Now, I do recognize that perhaps this court wishes to consider a notice of default acceleration, but I would caution this court to look solely to a notice of default to be the sole act of acceleration, because as Ms. Glass's counsel mentioned, we need to look at the deed of trust to determine how you accelerate. The deed of trust simply requires a letter, a notice in writing to the borrower. There's no requirement that it's a recorded document, nor is there any declaration from this court saying that the affirmative act of acceleration requires always a recorded document. So that's where the problem comes in. There could be acceleration, but we would never know that. A third party, a stranger to the loan, such as Ms. Glass, who, as counsel admits, is not the borrower under the loan. She never assumed the loan. She is a third party. If there was an acceleration done by simply a letter to the borrower, no third party would ever know it. In the same way, a notice of default may accelerate the due date under the note, but subsequently the lender and the borrower could enter into an agreement to modify the loan. There's nothing in Nevada law that requires a loan modification to be recorded against the property. So that loan modification could be the affirmative act that necessarily decelerates the loan. So there's all these additional actions that could happen outside the parameters of 106.240 that are simply not a part of the plain language of the statute. So looking at the plain language alone, we can only look at the four corners of the deed of trust and see that that holy due date is January 1st, 2036. Moreover, Your Honors, if we assume hypothetically that 106.240 is triggered because the notice of default is an acceleration, and assuming that 106.240 intended acceleration to be read into the statute, despite the fact that its plain meaning and its plain language shows that there is no consideration of acceleration, only an extension of the holy due date. So if we make all those assumptions, then we get to the fact that there is a recorded rescission here. And this court has already considered that identical language that Ms. Glass's counsel raised before you today. And that was in the Holt decision from almost 10 years ago. In that case, this court considered the identical language regarding rescinding a notice of default and its effect. And this court clearly stated that a rescission renders moot all disputes concerning the notice of default and its timing. So again, we have been taken out of the context of 106-240 by the plain language of the statute and the fact that this court has already considered identical rescission language. And I would point this court's attention to compare the Holt decision at page 890 with volume 3, page 411 of the record, which is a copy of the recorded rescission. It's identical language. This court already looked at it and already decided that that was sufficient to cancel the prior notice of default and render it moot, as well as rendering its timing moot, which means that even if 106-240 had been triggered, it is no longer triggered. That is no longer an applicable statute to this particular quiet title action. And Your Honor,
I think we understand that argument you're making. Let's talk about the note and the assignment. Now, my recollection is Countrywide was acquired by Bank of America during the financial crisis, I believe in 2008. Did Countrywide still exist as a subsidiary of Bank of America, or was it dissolved? As Mr. Kern says, it doesn't exist. Tell us what happened so we can deal with the authority to sign the document in question.
Right, Your Honor, and I'd actually go so far as to say that those facts are not at issue in the record on this appeal. You're right that Countrywide does not exist anymore, and my apologies, I don't recall if it was because it was dissolved or there was a bankruptcy, but at all pertinent times related to the prior judicial foreclosure action and now in this quiet title action, Countrywide is out of the picture. It's no longer the assigned beneficiary, and it is not the holder of the note.
Okay. Well, I think Mr. Kern is saying that the district court erred in concluding there was standing here for your client because of the assignment issue, the chain of title on the note. Can you tell us what your position is?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's not quite a correct recollection of the Court of Appeals decision. So the Court of Appeals in the prior judicial foreclosure action determined that SPS had not met its evidentiary burden with proving it had the right to enforce the subsequently lost note. So in the prior, before the district court, previously in the judicial foreclosure action, there was an evidentiary hearing. The district court found that SPS did prove its standing to enforce the lost note, but subsequently on appeal, that was reversed. But the really important part of that reversal, Your Honor, is that the Court of Appeals simply stated, written decision, that SPS, on the evidence presented at the evidentiary hearing, did not meet its evidentiary burden to show it had standing to enforce the lost note. That was it. There was no further order or consideration or even discussion of whether the inability to prove its standing at that point in time on the record subsequently meant that SPS had forever lost its ability to enforce the loan and proceed with foreclosure. And that's what this court told us in Holt. Look at the foreclosure mediation program and whether certificate issues, which we know that foreclosure mediation can be elected whether a lender has elected to proceed with a non-judicial or a judicial foreclosure. A borrower can still elect mediation. And in the foreclosure program, if a certificate does not issue because the lender hasn't met its requirements under the statute, this court in Holt very clearly said that simply because the certificate does not issue does not mean the lender's right has been extinguished. Nothing in the foreclosure mediation statutes or rules suggests that denial of the certificate permanently costs the lender the security it is afforded by the deed of trust. And that's exactly what happened in the judicial foreclosure case. It was simply a ruling that, for all intents and purposes, the equivalent of a certificate, a court order, could not issue because SPS had not met its evidentiary burden. But in issue preclusion, Your Honors, that's only one part of the analysis. So issue preclusion has, as we know, three separate elements that must all be met in order to preclude further judicial action. We don't dispute that it's the same parties to the judicial foreclosure action and this quiet title action. But the second element is that the issue must have been identical. And Ms. Glass takes issue with the fact that the district court in this quiet title action said that because we have a quiet title and a judicial foreclosure action, those two claims are entirely separate and therefore issue preclusion doesn't apply. And using the word claim instead of issue, what the court was getting at is you have two entirely separate types of actions, and therefore necessarily we have two entirely distinct issues. In the judicial foreclosure case, we had the issue of, is SPS permitted to enforce the lost note? In this quiet title action, we have Ms. Glass asking this court to determine whether she is entitled to quiet title in her favor, free and clear of any recorded encumbrance. Now, so that necessarily means we're talking about the deed of trust. The note is not at issue in a quiet title action. So we're talking about apples and oranges. The prior action concerns the note, and SPS is standing to enforce it. Here we're talking about a deed of trust appearing as a valid encumbrance on the property.
Yeah, but Ms. Miller, so the deed of trust is a security interest of the note. If the note is not valid, the security interest is null and void as a matter of law. I mean, so you have to have the two of them. The note has to exist in order to, for the security instrument to have any legal effect. Do you disagree with that?
No, I do not, Your Honor. And in fact, that's what the Edelstein opinion tells us, is that you must have a unification of both the note and the deed of trust in order to have standing to proceed with a foreclosure. We don't dispute that. But there simply has not been a ruling from any court that for some reason the note is no longer a valid enforceable document, or that the deed of trust is not enforceable either.
Okay, well, so, how did your current client, the servicer you represent, what legal trail was submitted to the district court in this quiet title case to show that the note, they properly acquired the servicing rights initially from Countrywide to the current servicer? What evidence was produced to satisfy that?
Right. So, Your Honor, we have the fact that in a quiet title action where we're talking about the deed of trust, that concerns who the beneficiary is. And currently, U.S. Bank is the assigned beneficiary of the deed of trust. We also have SPS is the holder, as the servicing agent for U.S. Bank, it's the holder of the deed of trust on behalf of U.S. Bank. In the prior action, unfortunately, it appeared that they were unable to locate the note, and subsequently 104.3309 was invoked in order for that evidentiary hearing to be held to determine if SPS could prove through other means that it was entitled to enforce the note at that point. But there's never been any dispute that SPS is entitled to enforce the deed of trust as the servicing agent for U.S. Bank, the current beneficiary of record of that document.
Well, I Your think Honor, Mr. Kern's arguing that if you don't have ownership of the note or you have the authority to act as a servicer, you can't enforce the deed of trust, you know, like that. So what's your position on that?
Your Honor, I would say that's another issue for another day. That is not the issue in a quiet title action. If there was a pending foreclosure, yes, absolutely, I would be standing here before you saying I need to prove up on behalf of SPS and U.S. Bank that they are the holder of the note and the beneficiary of record, which those statements are in the record here, Your Honor. But again, in a quiet title action, there's simply no requirement under Nevada law that we produce the original note to the court, to Ms. Glass. It's simply not there. The only requirement is if a mediation is elected, those documents must be brought to the mediation.
Okay.
And, Your Honor, I see I'm out of...
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry.
So I just want to make sure I understand this. Your position is it's not relevant to the quiet title action. However, if we ruled in your client's favor in this case, and then you started foreclosure against Ms. Glass, Mr. Kern would have the right to come in and ask for an injunction from the court saying, wait a minute, you know, they don't have the note and they don't have a proper ownership trail on the note, so therefore the court should enjoin the foreclosure. So you're not saying he's prohibited from doing that on behalf of his client. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. If there was a subsequent foreclosure, whether it's judicial or non-judicial, he would be entitled to come in on behalf of his client and challenge ownership of the note, the right to proceed under the deed of trust if there was a valid assignment. We don't dispute that he is still allowed to raise those defenses, just simply that those were never raised previously in the judicial foreclosure action. They were not ruled on by a court, and they simply cannot, we can't read that preclusive effect into the prior court of appeals order.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate
Thank you,
that.
Your Honors.
Okay. Mr. Kern, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few things, so I'm going to try to get through them quickly. First, with regard to Your Honor Justice Gibbons' question about 107080 and the grace period attached to that, I wanted to explain that the grace period referred to in that statute is simply 35 days extra for the borrower to make good on that, but it does not undo anything about the acceleration. It simply gives 35 days in which they can undo that freely, after which it becomes permanent. There's no showing or no allegation that anything of that sort happened, and even if we add the 35 days, we're still well within 10 years from that acceleration point. Regarding Ms. Miller's comments that the statute requires we limit ourselves to these, the deed of trust, et cetera, first of all, that's adding something the statute clearly doesn't say, which directly goes against PROMAX. It says becomes wholly due. It can be wholly due through maturity. It can be wholly due through acceleration. And we have to look at the fact that acceleration is part of the deed of trust. The deed of trust makes clear that that is a way the deed of trust can become wholly due. I think we're taking Holt out of context, and I would just ask the court to refer to the briefing on that issue. Finally, as to the last issue that we are discussing, yes, she just admitted that, yeah, maybe they can never enforce this. This is why we have equity. This is why we do that, because we are not meant to have a formalistic rule that means that we have a vacuum.
Mr. Kern, let me interrupt you for a moment. Your complaint includes in paragraph 22 a heading, offer of tender, and it says, upon any of defendants' entitlement, establishment of its right to receive payments under the note, plaintiff hereby offers to tender payment of the mortgage by its terms. That's part of your debt relief complaint. Doesn't that line up with what Ms. Miller was just saying as far as what's at issue here is you trying to quiet title and leaving for another day any foreclosure on the note were that to be commenced?
Your Honor, we are not doing that. We believe that there is no party that's been able to establish the right to be owed that. So we're looking at because we frequently hear in these cases that he who seeks equity must do equity from the McQuitty Supreme Court case. However, the equity also says there can't be a right without a remedy, and equity abhors a vacuum. This is the type of thing it's meant to fix, to not have a property in limbo with a cloud on title that can never be enforced but can never be gotten rid of. That's why equity is meant to be flexible on issues like this. So there is no reason that we would ever allow a lien that can't be enforced to survive quiet title. That's what they have to demonstrate in order to show that it should remain as a lien on the property. And finally, I ask that this court remember that we are on a motion for summary judgment standard. And while I believe this can be decided on 106-240 on the law alone, I would remind the court that if they disagree on that, that we are looking at the MSJ standard of dispute of fact, and we very clearly, at the very least, have a dispute as to the applicability of the note in the MSJ against us.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kern. Ms. Miller, we appreciate excellent arguments from both of you. A very interesting case. Thank you for bringing it to us, and we will and thank you for participating in our video conferencing here, remote arguments. So with that being said, we'll take the case under submission, and the court will be in recess until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.